and welcome to The Right Side. I am Andrea Ruth, and I'm here with my fellow host, Kim Ross. How are you?
I'm doing great, Andrea. How are you?
I'm great. And joining us today to talk about the recent, we've had quite a week with the Supreme Court, with decisions coming down and also the retirement, the announced retirement of Anthony Kennedy. We have Georgetown Law professor and author of Our Republican Constitution, Randy Barnett, is joining us. Thank you, Randy, for being here.
Well, thanks for having me. It's a great pleasure.
All right. So this whole week has been just kind of like a flood of decision after decision that really went. What do you think, first off, of with the most recent justice being there, Neil Gorsuch? How much do you think that these decisions were really weighted by him being there and especially when it comes to the Janus decision, which was about public and private sector unions? How much do you think that Gorsuch really affected those decisions coming down, or if at all?
Well, I think this really underscores how important the election of 2016 was. Had that election gone the other way, as most people, including myself, thought it was going to go the other way, many of the decisions that you saw this term were not going to happen this way. We would have had a different Supreme Court. And from going forward, we would have had a different constitution, and to the point where I was actually planning on leaving constitutional law myself and returning to contracts as my field of specialty, because there really wasn't going to be any point, given my age, of continuing this pursuit any farther. We are now living on, we're now enjoying bonus round. We are playing on the house's money, pick your favorite metaphor. And the chance of restoring the original meaning of the Constitution still exists. We haven't done it yet, and we still don't have five votes on the Supreme Court necessarily to do that. But we do have a five vote block of justices who will reach results that are consistent with original meaning, even if they don't always use originalist techniques themselves to reach those results.
Yeah.
And two of the big decisions this week, as Andrea was talking about, the Janus decision and also the NIFLA versus Becerra decision, those were two huge decisions in favor of the freedom of speech. And so my question is, why is there so much opposition to this from the left? Obviously, they have their own issues with freedom of speech and freedom of religion and everything, but these uphold someone's ability, whether they're in a pro-life pregnancy center or whether they're part of a union and don't want to, you know, pay the funds to support the union. It allows people their own voice and their own decision making. So why is the left so opposed to that?
Well, I have to say that there are some real free speech problems on the left these days. When I was, in college, it was an article of faith amongst libertarians that the conservatives and the liberals were each defective in their own way, and that the left was good on civil liberties and the right was good on economic liberties, which was, I think, always was never really the case. But the right was bad on civil liberties and the left was bad on economic liberties. I think we are living in a different political environment now, and libertarians really ought to bring themselves up to speed. The left has serious problems with civil liberties. Sometimes they have problems with proof beyond a reasonable doubt when people are accused of misconduct. Sometimes they have problems with freedom of speech. Now, having said that, let me say that these last two cases, as well as the Masterpiece Bake Shop case, do raise a separate a sub issue with respect to freedom of speech that is a difficult one. It's not super easy. It's not the case that these cases involve stopping people from speaking, which is your core freedom of speech issue, which the left does have a problem with, which is why they're, chasing speakers off campuses is a bad thing. But these cases all involve what can be called compelled speech, making people speak, making people say something that they don't want to say. Even though there is a longstanding doctrine dating back to West Virginia versus Barnett that says that compelled speech is a violation of the First Amendment, is just like prohibiting speech is, it is sometimes difficult to identify exactly what is compelled speech and what is not compelled speech. And that leaves room for disagreements, reasonable disagreement amongst people who have a hard time drawing. There's a hard time drawing a line. I don't want to filibuster here, but I did attend the Masterpiece Cake Shop oral argument, help brief Jack Phillips's lawyers. I mean, I'm not. I helped moot them and prepare them to do the oral argument. But I will say that they had a kind of hard time in court drawing a line on a slippery slope to figure out, well, exactly where does speech, compelled speech, end, and where does public accommodations and providing services for people on a non-discriminatory basis begin? So these are difficult issues, and we shouldn't underestimate them. And it's these, and but given their instincts and given their political preferences, this does give people who are progressives, left to center people, an argument as to why these are not really free speech cases. I hope that makes some sense.
That does, and especially with the Masterpiece Cake Shop, I have heard some people say that the reason they sided with Jack Phillips was because the issue at hand occurred in 2012 before gay marriage was legalized. And had that issue, you know, happened after the ruling legalizing gay marriage, the court might not have sided in his favor. Does that hold any weight?
Well, that certainly was one of the things that I think influenced Justice Kennedy, who was the swing vote in that case. But I do think the other thing, the way the case came out, and as people, it's been reported that it came out in a very narrow decision. I think that's right. It was very narrow. The way that case was came out was on the basis of anti-religious animus that was shown by the commissioners deciding that case. And so it was actually on very specialized facts that Jack Phillips prevailed. He got to win, but it's not clear that other people who like Jack Phillips will win in the future if the government is more circumspect in how they decide the case against them. So right. It was a very limited victory. And what people who are on Jack Phillips' side are feeling about that is that a limited victory was a lot better than a loss would have been. And then hopefully live to fight another day when a case where the animus is not so clear comes before the court.
Yeah, I think we'll definitely, I mean, there is no question we will see this come around again, and they're eventually won't be able to, you know, kick the can proverbially down the road on this issue further. And I'm not sure, I think everybody's a little bit nervous about how that would even, you know, come out at this point. I did want to ask you about one of the lesser known rulings that came out. I can't remember when this one was, but it's the one about Carpenter versus United States, where police were told, yes, you do have to have. I mean, that was one of the ones that was kind of like, I didn't hear anything about it until I was preparing and I was kind of going over what all rulings came out, and that the police, you know, privacy rights in a digital age, that you do have to have you know, a warrant to search someone's phone records and even to get cell tower information. That seems like something that, you know, unless you're dealing with the police and dealing with a criminal case or something like that, that you wouldn't need to worry about. But I think all of us do kind of worry about, or at least in the past have worried about, you know, of course we all heard about metadata and stuff like that. I mean, these are things that just seem like basic rights, but yet they had to be spelled out. So how did that one, like, will be affecting Americans, you know, and legislation, and in a real sense, I guess is what I'm trying to say. I didn't.
I got it. I'm a very big privacy guy. I believe that I'm against bulk data collection. I think that's unconstitutional, actually, because it constitutes what the founders would have recognized to be a general warrant, where you just collect the information in advance of having probable cause, and then you search through the information to find damaging things. I think that's what bulk data collection does. I'm with Senator Paul on that. Having said that, however, I do try to evaluate these constitutional cases by first looking at what the Constitution says, and then seeing whether the Supreme Court's doctrines that have implemented the Constitution make sense, and before I reach my conclusion as to what I think the right outcome is. And even though I like the privacy outcome of Carpenter, I was very impressed with the dissenting opinions by both Justices Thomas and Gorsuch, which analyzed the text of the Constitution, and which in Justice Thomas's case suggest that the cell tower information is not something that is protected by the Fourth Amendment, that's supposed to protect the people in their persons, papers, houses, and effects, since cell tower information is not the property or even the delegated property of the individuals whose rights are being affected here, which is you and me. It's the property of the phone company. Having said that, Justice Gorsuch's concurring dissenting opinion was very, very interesting because he points for he rejects the reasonable expectation of privacy test of cats, which is what the court, the majority used, and which I think is a very, very problematic test, in favor of a more property-based test, which he could then see extend farther up to and including, for example, our emails, which are our property that we put in the possession of other people. It's not clear to me that if he had been the fifth vote, he might not have actually gone with the majority and then issued a concurring opinion. But he, because he was not the fifth vote, he was free to be a dissenting opinion and get his voice more clearly heard. I think Justice Gorsuch's opinion describes a way forward for originalists to protect privacy at an even higher level than the progressives on the court are prepared to do with the reasonable expectation of privacy test.
And Randy, one of the biggest issues I like to focus on is the pro-life issue. I like to write about it and discuss about it quite a bit. And right after Kennedy's announced that he would retire in, you know, the end of July, there was, I had so many people asking me, well, you know, what do you think about the possibility of Roe getting overturned? This is going to happen. It's going to, you know, happen this next cycle with this new justice, and it's, you know, on the horizon. It's going to happen. So after Trump picks his second justice and they're confirmed and seated, what is the real possibility of getting Roe even before the court again? And what exactly would it take to get to that point? And I know it, I mean, to me, it seems like an incredible stretch that it would even, you know, get to that point in our lifetimes. But I see the left collectively kind of freaking out at the thought of this. So what do you think about the possibility?
Well, this is definitely their talking point. This is going to be what they are going to make this Supreme Court nomination hearing all about. And the reason why is because, as Justice Kennedy was a swing vote in the Casey case, and Casey is the case is that actually governs us now. Roe does not govern us anymore. Casey does. And Justice Kennedy was in the, it was in the majority, wrote the three judge opinion, per curiam opinion, explaining why the woman's right to choose was protected up through the least up to at least through viability. So that's why this is going to be salient. It is going to be salient. Obviously, with Justice Kennedy not on the court, it really almost wouldn't matter who President Trump would choose. It would make more likely that Roe versus Wade or Casey, Planned Parenthood versus Casey, would be reconsidered. So let me just say that if I were somebody, if I was a progressive non-originalist, I would not be happy with the current state situation. I would not be happy that Justice Kennedy resigned and I retired, and I would not be happy that President Trump is going to replace him. So it would. I don't want to sugarcoat this for the other side. On the other hand, if you look, for example, at the gay marriage decision, which you're not really hearing a lot about from them, I think that there's virtually no chance whatsoever that the Supreme Court would revisit that issue. Mm-hmm. So, and that's just on strictly judicial political grounds. I think that's a situation where that train has left the station, and I don't think that there would be five votes for that. I don't think there would be four votes for even hearing the case. The abortion context is a little different because the conservative legal movement has put Roe and Casey in their sights for 30 years, or if not more. And those cases are not settled as far as they're concerned. And so there's always the possibility that they will be reconsidered.
Yeah. And there's I mean, they definitely have been hair on fire about the whole Kennedy retirement. The DNC had a, you know, recorded phone call. I don't think it was leaked. I think it was just published where, you know, they kind of acknowledged that Kennedy hadn't been, you know, their best advocate on the court recently. And but when it, going back to the Janus decision, and
well, let me interrupt for a second, just because as a statistic that your listeners might be interested in, the justice on the Supreme Court who agreed the most last term with Justice Kennedy at 90% was John Roberts. Mm-hmm. John Roberts is still going to be on the court. He's going to become the swing vote almost no matter who President Trump names. Mm-hmm. John Roberts will now be the swing vote. Somebody always is the swing vote. Right. Sandra O'Connor was the swing vote. Then it became Kennedy. Now it'll be Roberts. He voted with Kennedy 90% of the time. And you know who voted with Kennedy the second most frequently? And that was Neil Gorsuch. He voted with Kennedy 85% of the time. So if the president nominates somebody like Neil Gorsuch, the results, the outcomes are not going to be remarkably different than the outcomes. And that voting pattern holds true. And this year, this term might not be representative. Justice Kennedy might have voted more conservatively this term. We don't know. I mean, so these, you know, these statistics are not, you know, they're sometimes not worth that much. But at least based on this particular one, if you want to get a justice that votes very close to what Justice Kennedy votes, you got to pick somebody like Neil Gorsuch around, next time around.
Yeah,
that's interesting that you mentioned John Roberts would be the swing vote. I think a lot of people think whomever Trump nominates this next time and who gets, you know, seated this time will be the swing vote. But as you were saying, John Roberts will be the swing vote. That's interesting. I've never thought about it that way before.
Yeah, John Roberts will be the swing vote. John Roberts is not a committed originalist. Mm-hmm. He is. I don't think there's any question he's politically conservative, but he's also very concerned about the impression that the Roberts Court leaves on the general public. He's concerned about the legacy of the Roberts Court, how it plays in different political circles in a way that an originalist, I think, would not be so concerned with. And so as a result, he is going to be the swing judge, and I think he's going to enjoy being the swing justice. The swing justice is who everybody argues for. Everybody else kind of, it's like being the swing states in the Electoral College map. All the ads and all the campaigning goes on in, what, 8 states? And everybody else gets ignored. So this is true in the Supreme Court. I mean, all the arguments were aimed at Justice Kennedy are now going to be aimed at John Roberts. That's not going to be a position he hates being in, I have to tell you.
Right.
So I just really quick to go back to, because I do want to talk lastly about the who Trump might be in. Nominating and how that will go down in the Senate. But I just want to revisit really quick about the Janus decision. And, you know, what I was saying before was that, you know, this is going to, what we saw before when is that unions have lost a lot of membership. And now they were still able to collect dues despite non-membership. I live in a state where it's not a right-to-work state. I don't believe. The last time I checked, Washington State was not a right-to-work state. But how will this affect states like mine or states that aren't right-to-work states where people are – will those states still be able to have those kinds of laws, compelled unions, or has this ruined all of that?
Well, at first I was very – I thought this decision was going to have a really big impact because, as you know, public sector unions, which are not the same as private sector unions, public sector unions, which have grown in recent years, private sector unions have not grown. Public sector unions essentially take tax money, which is paid to the salaries of their workers. So this is money paid by the taxpayer. And they take a certain amount of that out and send it over to the Democratic Party because 99% of public sector union political contributions are spent on helping Democrats get elected. So that's a way of funneling tax money from us. Even if you're in Washington state, there are some Republicans that are still living there. And that money is getting funneled to the Democratic Party via the public sector union. So I thought, well, this is an opinion that's going to stop that. Mm-hmm. And that'll be major. On the other hand, I just saw a blog post by my co-blogger, Eugene Volokh of UCLA Law School on the Volokh Conspiracy, is the blog we have, in which he points out that one workaround, which is going to probably be would probably sustain challenging, is if the state legislature would just give public sector unions employees a slight pay cut, and rather than pay them salaries, the state legislature makes a direct payment to the unions for services that the unions render their employees. That would eliminate pretty much the compelled speech aspect, which was what was the basis of this particular ruling, and still allow money to go directly from the taxpayers to the unions and then on to the Democratic Party. And I wouldn't put it past state legislatures dominated by Democrats where you have a Democrat governor from doing this sort of thing as a workaround of this case, in which case it's not going to be as big a decision as it looked like it was going to be.
Yeah, I think I saw actually it was a New York I don't know if it was Kristen Gillibrand or not, but it was someone from New York say that, like, we should just, you know, the government, the state governments or whoever, should just give money to the unions to advocate on their behalf.
And of course, what this means is giving taxpayer money to the Democratic Party by means of the unions. Let me just say, you know, for listeners who think that's a little too cynical, ask yourself, would Democrats be supporting this policy if unions gave 99% of their funding to support Republicans being elected? Mm-hmm. I predict the answer to that is no. And you can, and your listeners are free to disagree with me if they wish.
They wouldn't be very smart then. So, Kim, did you have a question about who is going to be possibly nominated?
Yes, Randy. Yesterday, Trump announced that he planned to, you know, discuss what his choice would be for the court on July 9th. And he did say he's considering two women. And I'm not very familiar, you know, with all of them, but I have heard a lot about Amy Coney Barrett and her background and everything, and that she would be an excellent choice. She's a Catholic, a mom with plenty of children, and she would probably be under a lot of fire during the confirmation hearings, even though there's not quite a possibility that the Democrats would be able to, you know, shoot her down, but she would definitely be under fire. What do you think of her? And also, what is your overall, you know, thoughts about the nomination process, and who do you have in mind?
Well, I just have to tell you what I tell everyone else and what I told everybody else during the lead up to the Gorsuch nomination. That is, I know quite a few people on this list of 25. I know people who are going to be on the short list. I like the people I know. There's many people on the list I don't know. Therefore, I don't like or dislike them. And I refuse to either say too many nice things about the people I know or too many, which would actually provide, and I won't, you know, criticize them either, because at this point, I need to keep an open mind. Let me just say that at this point in the process, well, actually, I don't know if it was this point in the process, because the president apparently is going to make his pick on July 9th. So we're really pretty close. But at some point during the process, I did not know Neil Gorsuch at all. I've never met him. I'd never read anything he's done. I knew nothing about him. And yet he came to be on the shortlist. I then did a very, very quick remedial research onto Neil Gorsuch, even read his book. And everything I read about him made me very, very positive about him as the selection. And I was pleased when the president nominated him by the time that happened. But if you'd have asked me several weeks earlier what I thought, I would have talked about other people, not Neil Gorsuch. And yet I'm very happy with how this came out. So as a result, I just won't discuss individuals. The only thing I will do when I think the time comes, I think, is I'll try to deflect what I think is unfair, fake news criticisms of them. Of any of them, whether they're my favorites or not. It's already starting, of course. But if this hadn't been timed this way, what we were going to get was television ads, negative television ads on most of the people on the shortlist. There was already money being raised to do that. And that would have given us great oppo research paid for by the opponents, by the Democrats, on what who they think is strong and who they think is weak. But we didn't get the benefit of that. We're now going to have to go into this and do the best we can. Yes. I do know Amy Comey very well. I mean, not very well. I know her. She actually wrote a law review article criticizing my latest book, Our Republican Constitution. She participated in the symposium about the book, and everybody was asked to write a critical comment, and she wrote hers. I actually reread her critical comment yesterday. So she disagrees with me about some important issues, and yet I thought the article was really quite good and displayed a tremendous familiarity with originalism and the details of originalist theory, which I would like to see the next justice have that familiarity. So even though she was critical of me, I thought the article was still kind of a mark in her favor.
Yeah, I saw an article that said this is looking like it's going to be the most expensive Supreme Court nomination, not for the government or anything, but that the private interest groups are going to be funneling a lot of money into on the one side attacking, and then, you know, the other side Trump supporting, ostensibly Trump supporting PACs and other types of private groups will be buying a lot of ads, doing the reverse side. So.
Well, I think everybody should keep in mind that the first time that television ads were purchased to oppose a Supreme Court nominee was I had purchased by People for the American Way against Robert Bork. So Google People for the American Way, Robert Bork advertisement, and it's online. It's on YouTube. You can watch the first dark money paid for ad politicizing or at least politically opposing the nomination of a Supreme Court justice. That's when it started. And after that, it is just, you know, snowballed predictably. And I don't doubt that this is going to be a big one.
Right.
Yeah. And it's true that, I mean, I read somewhere, and I agree with it, that you don't necessarily want a, you know, conservative or liberal justice. You want someone who follows the Constitution. Now, the chances of you getting someone who believes in the, you know, the text of the Constitution is more likely going to be a conservative. But you don't necessarily need someone that's ideologically, you know, quote unquote conservative or, you know, progressive or just how they fall generally in their opinions on those kinds of things. When we're looking at the Senate, obviously has to have the hearing and go through the confirmation and then vote. We're looking at, just to kind of wrap things up, we're looking at John McCain being absent, due to illness, and we don't know if he's going to be able to make it back. That whittles down the number of Republicans who would likely vote for, and really John McCain, you know, has voted against, you know, has been very vocal against Donald Trump. And but will red state Democrats like Joe Manchin and Claire McCaskill be more susceptible to, I mean, because Democrats are very much like, I mean, hold the line, we need to pull out every measure, we need to, you know, they have very little answers for what that means, what that actually looks like when they're in the minority. But what's the, I guess, likelihood that we can get some Democrats to vote for Trump's Supreme Court nominee when they are so, you know, against it just as a prince on principle for them?
Well, two things. First of all, given the fact that the vitriol we're already hearing about anybody Trump picks and all the arguments for why he shouldn't even be allowed to make a pick because of the independent counsel or the fact that it's an election year, this should just tell you that whatever arguments are made against any particular candidate that you hear is obviously pretextual, because they would oppose any candidate. So it's not like any argument you hear about anyone in particular is really about them. It's really going to be about any candidate the president would come up with, they'll have stuff to say about. So that's number one. Number two, this comes at a pretty unfortunate time for Democrats who are standing for re-election in states that went for Donald Trump, because they're going to be trying to run as an independent Democrat who has an independent mind, and yet the base of their party is going to absolutely demand a vote, a party line vote on this issue. Mm-hmm. Again, irrespective of the qualities of the particular nominee, it's just going to be a matter of party, put party over that issue. And so, but they're going to have to run for, they're standing for re-election. They're going to be put in a very uncomfortable position. And my guess is that at least some of them will support a nominee if that nominee is as able, has as good a record and is able to defend himself or herself as Neil Gorsuch was. So some of it's going to come down to who the pick is and whether that pick is going to be good at defending him or herself, or bad, because if that pick shows weaknesses and unable to defend themselves, the other side gets under their skin and actually gets them on the run, that's going to cause even some Republicans to bolt, like Susan Collins or Lisa Murkowski. And so there's the very, very, very bare majority that the Republicans have in the Senate is no guarantee of a successful outcome here with respect to this pick. We've seen candidates go down in flames before, and, you know, you could see it again.
Yeah, George W. Bush had a nominee that ended up pulling out. I can't remember her name anymore. Oh, well.
Was it Harriet Myers?
Yes, Harriet Myers. Mm-hmm. Who was his White House counsel?
Yeah, and again, she wasn't able to, like you said, defend herself very well. I remember that fairly
well. It didn't get that far, because she actually withdrew while she was still, you know, engaged in office visits with senators and stuff. So mm-hmm. It never got to a hearing.
Yeah.
But Robert Bork had a sort of a hard time defending himself because, you know, the terrain had shifted by the time he had to testify, and he wasn't necessarily expecting to get the kinds of questions that he got. Whatever reason, he gave the opposition ammunition, and Neil Gorsuch did not this time around. But you never know. You just never know. It's going to be tough, and as you've already pointed out, it's going to be hard fought.
Yeah, and the media did try to create a rift between Neil Gorsuch and Trump before his hearing as well by leaking stuff that he had said about Trump. So Randy, thank you so much for being here.
Yes, thank you.
Well, it was a great pleasure. I'm so glad I was able to do so.
And where can everybody reach you on the internet?
Yes, well, my website is randybarnett.com. You can buy my book, Our Republican Constitution, on Amazon. It usually sells for about $14.50 in hardcover, and it's a book that I wrote for the general public. And you can follow me on Twitter at Randy E. Barnett, R-A-N-D-Y, middle initial E, B-A-R-N-E-T-T.
All right. Thank you so much again.
Okay, take care. Enjoy your weekend.
Thank you, you too.
Bye.
Well, I really enjoyed that interview, Kim. What did you think?
I did too, and I think, well, he had a lot of good insight, of course, from his background. But when I asked him the question about who he thought would be good for the nomination and what did he think about the list, his answer was perfect, and it did not exactly answer my question, but it was a perfect answer because he doesn't need to have some sort of feeling about the nominees based on what he knows about them or their political backgrounds. I think a lot of times conservatives as well as liberals, when they think of a nominee, they instantly say, we want someone that sides with us in our politics. But really, Americans should want someone who's, an originalist, textualist, and focuses on the Constitution, not so much on politicians and, their opinions.
Right. Yeah. I think we get a lot of chatter and it's a process that sometimes I have a really mixed feelings about things like C-SPAN, and air. People always want it on TV. Well, the American public should see it. It's like, yeah, but then it becomes just grandstanding type of thing. This is why I quit watching cable news back in January. And I have never been happier. I read all my news and I'm just like, oh, I can skip all the, the affect and way people say things. It's really nice.
I do too. It's not bad at all.
Yeah. So you had an exciting week last week. As listeners know, we recorded early last week because Kim was off. Where were you, Kim?
I went to the 3rd annual Pro-Life Women's Conference in St. Louis.
How was it? You drove there.
Fantastic. I drove there about 7 hours, but I stayed awake because I had some great podcasts to listen to. And speaking of podcasts, you should subscribe to our podcast, and you should also leave a review of our podcast. But as I was talking about the conference, it's the 3rd annual one, and it is kind of put together by Abby Johnson, who I'm sure plenty of people are aware of her. She was a former Planned Parenthood director, and she became a pro-life advocate. She has her own nonprofit organization called And Then There Were None, and the main goal of that organization is to essentially pull abortion workers out of the industry and make them big pro-life voices and everything. So this was the 3rd conference. She did not expect to do this conference every year, but the response to it and the desire actually for it has been pretty overwhelming. There has been about 500 women every year, and so they're planning on it again next year. Of course, we had a really good crowd there, and I really appreciate the conference because, well, one of the big things that they focus on is loving women through the difficult time that they find themselves in if they find themselves with an unwanted pregnancy, an unplanned pregnancy. And I know a lot of pro-lifers believe that women out there exist like this, that have babies within their wombs that they don't want. But we really need to understand that not every woman who gets pregnant wants the child. And we should want every woman to want the child, of course. But until she gets to that point, we should love her through it. And we should show her all the options she has for a care and supplies and even a lot of these pro-life organizations, they even have homes for women to stay in if they don't have another place to go. If they have family members or boyfriends, significant others who are against, this pregnancy, They can find resources at these pregnancy centers and other things. So it's a really, the focus there is loving women and showing them compassion and care. We don't need to shove pictures of aborted babies in their faces. Mm-hmm. They're pretty aware of what happens if they choose abortion. So I think love is the number one thing that, you know, is kind of on the list there when we're talking about what is discussed. Another thing I really love, they have, for lack of a better term, they have a lot of diversity in the pro-life movement, and this is really on display at the conference. There are booths set up in a general area for all attendees to visit, and there are Democrats for Life, LGBT for Life, secular pro-life, all these different things that people don't really think about. Because when they think about the pro-life movement, it's either all Republicans or all white people or
Christians.
All straight people, straight Christian, yeah, everything. But there are people literally of every background that you can imagine there. I went to a talk from Feminist for Life with a Destiny, I forget her whole name, that's so horrible, it's right here. Destiny Herndon De La Rosa, that's her whole name. And she is very loud and proud about being a pro-life feminist, and she gets plenty of flack from the, you know, left feminist side, and they hate her for her stance and everything. But when at her talk, she had one of her colleagues with her, and this woman is a pro-life advocate. She's very passionate about helping women. She's also an African-American female, and she is a lesbian. And that is not, I'm just describing her so people understand that there is plenty of diversity in the pro-life movement. And we don't have to all agree on political issues. We don't have to have the same backgrounds. We don't have to have the same ideas on social changes and things that go on there. But we can all be united in protecting unborn life and helping women as they go through the whole situation. Another group of people that were there, there was a woman from an organization called Embryo Defense, and I went to a talk about frozen embryos, and the title of the talk was "The Next Pro-Life Issue is Here." And I find that pretty interesting. I've been reading up recently about the frozen embryo kind of issue, I should say, and there are so many people, it seems, like our age, maybe a little bit younger, who are having problems with infertility. And so they look towards fertility treatments to help them have a child, which I have obviously no issue with, of course. But that lends itself to the problem of plenty of frozen embryos in all these clinics nationwide. When a woman goes through IVF treatment, there are plenty of essentially embryos that are, for lack of a better term, created and implanted, and not all of them take, mm-hmm. and not all of them that are created in the lab are used and planted in the woman. So as this woman at the frozen embryo talk was discussing, by about 2022, there will be about 1.5 to 2 million frozen embryos just sitting in labs around the country. And what do we think of the humanity of those embryos? Essentially, they're individual humans with their own unique DNA. They're just not in the, you know, biological space to grow and become a baby. But what do we think about that? Do we have, as pro-lifers, should we have a problem with that? Should we fight for their rights? And there's actually a lot of cases right now when one party in sort of a custody battle, if there's a couple that's together and they decide to not stay together anymore and they already have some embryos that are frozen, there's a custody battle that takes place. And one party will generally want them destroyed and the other party will want to keep them. And as pro-lifers, no matter what we think politically about other issues, where do we stand on this? I think it's something that really needs to be discussed because it's only growing. So those are a few things from the conference. And again, I just love it. And I'm going next year, wherever it is.
Sofia Vergara is actually, yes, was in a, yeah, mm-hmm. in a custody battle. She wanted the embryos to either stay or be destroyed, and her ex-fiance, right, wanted to keep them. Yeah.
And the woman that did this embryo defense talk, and she actually heads the embryo defense organization, she's a lawyer, and she was one of the lawyers that was trying to help the significant other of Sofia Vergara, actually, in that case, about, oh, wow, you know, keeping the embryos, because Sofia does not want them to go beyond where they are right now. So
is this just women?
It is just women. There were a few men there. And when I was sitting on, one of the talks I sat on, sat in on was called The Signs of the Female Cycle Explained. And there were a few men in there. And when you're talking about, and this might be TMI listeners, when you're talking about like cervical mucus and the the time in your cycle when you're ovulating, and I could tell the men in there who are either there to take photos or do video, they're like, oh dear, why am I sitting in on this? But it's biology, people, and you all got here because of that.
Yeah, it's really interesting, especially when you're like, I know you've talked at one point about hormonal birth control, and it's interesting. Like, I saw you talking about it, or did you tweet about it?
I think I put it on my Facebook. I think tweeted about it too. But that's another big issue. Are we for hormonal birth control? There's a lot of things it does to your body. What do pro-lifers think of that, and how it kind of suppresses your fertility? And that was a whole nother talk I went to as well. So it's great stuff.
Yeah. It was really just kind of interesting, because it's like, I was kind of like, I hate hormonal birth control too. I've always used, I use an app actually just to keep track.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah. Anyways, sorry guys that are listening. The one thing that I was going to say about, you know, it just, and it's fine that it's just women, that it's mostly women, and that it's for women, is that I always feel like men get so marginalized when on the pro-life issue. It's like women, the left and feminists and stuff like that, and have pretty much, you know, you see a lot, you're a guy, you don't get a say on this, mm-hmm. you know, kind of thing. I think that a lot of times men get put in the position of, you know, being told to basically sit down, you know, it's not their body. So sit down, like, you can't tell a woman what to do. It's like, well, it's half of them too. So
it is. And plenty of the speakers, including Abby Johnson, and I was able to sit aside with her for a little bit and ask her some questions. And they were all of the speakers were talking about how important it is to have pro-life men join with us in this whole thing. And obviously we have different subjects that we might talk about, like the signs of the female cycle explained that they may not want to sit on. But even as far as, like, you were talking about hormonal birth control, if the pill, especially when we're talking about that, that has kind of been, I guess, something that third wave feminists especially have used as well. If we don't want a kid, here's a pill. And because they've heard that said so, if men, I'm saying, have heard that said so many times, then they believe that their talking point should kind of be, well, if I'm with a woman and we don't want to get pregnant, well, just take the pill. And it's not necessarily that they know what they're talking about, but they've kind of heard this, it's been drilled into them. And maybe they want better for their significant other than the pill. Maybe they want something more natural, because women during a month, there's only a few days that they're actually fertile. Women are mostly infertile during a month. Mm-hmm. And it's okay for women to talk about this kind of thing with their significant other. What will it do to my body? What are the things we want to look at and precautions we want to take so we get pregnant when we want to? And these are discussions that women need to have with men, and it's okay to bring them in on it, because, as you said, they're half of the equation.
Yeah. And I've never heard of a good, you know, side effect or outcome of hormonal birth control. It's always, oh, it, you know, you have a higher instance of cancer in your later years. You have, you know, it's like, I've never heard a good one, you know, like weight gain, short-term and long-term. I've never heard of a good one except for, oh, you won't get pregnant if you take it perfectly all the time.
Yes,
so, and of
exactly.
course there are still, I know a couple women on Twitter that we follow who have said, like, look, I've got a birth control baby. Like, you know,
right.
you miss one pill and you're, so anyway, but all right. So, that's awesome. So, we'll skip our short, things again. Cause I spent so much time reading up on stuff, getting ready for Randy. I didn't find anything that annoyed me this week. Did something annoy you this week?
Well, I'm sure plenty of things annoy me this week, but we'll pick out something specific for next week, because we know for sure there will be something that happens during the week that
yes.
just trips our trigger.
So. You know, there is one thing I just thought of something. Tomorrow is Canada Day, and I live a mile from the Canadian border. I'm literally staying home in my house this weekend because I cannot stand. If you think Americans have an issue with overuse of handicap placards, Canadians are worse. And I just can't, I'm just not even going to deal with it. I told my daughter, I was like, we're home until Monday.
So. Is it the Canada Day stuff? Is it crazy?
Yeah, it's just they just all come down here.
Oh,
for the most part. So anyways, so that's my only annoyance. I love Canadians and stuff like that. I'm not a Canada hater. I you know, it's like Justin Trudeau's not my favorite prime minister. I actually think he's a little bit ridiculous. But at the same time, like, I need to stay home this weekend. And so I kind of like feel a little bit like oppressed, I guess. So we did at least one, but we'll definitely have them designated ones next week, so we're not so on the fly. So, all right, where can everybody reach you, Kim, if they're not following you? I don't know how they're finding this podcast if they don't follow us.
For real, exactly. You can reach me on Twitter at Southern Keeks, KEEKS. You can find my writing at Red State and Washington Examiner.
Alrighty, and you can find me at Andrea and Ruth on Twitter and at redstate.com. And we will see you next week on another episode of The Right Side. Bye!